This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. On today's show, we'll hear about a writing project for veterans.
All the people who don't speak about this stuff or who think, well, I'm not a writer, those are the people we want.
Plus, plans to manufacture the world's most expensive drug in Longmont may be put on hold.
And we hear from a man who decided the cycle of gang violence would end with him.
That's coming up.
It's Wednesday, August 28th. You're listening to Colorado Edition on KUNC. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Henry Zimmerman. Today, we're going to start with a conversation about the news and the editorial process, plus how news organizations tackle the label of fake news.
This past weekend, I hosted a discussion about media bias at E-Town Hall in Boulder. It featured Elizabeth Jensen, who's the public editor for NPR. She explained how NPR thinks about bias and its news coverage. Jensen began by telling us about her job.
My role essentially is to represent all of you. So I am a listener's advocate, if you will. I take the concerns of the listeners and the readers, if you're an NPR.org reader, and I help the newsroom understand what the concerns are. I don't work in the newsroom. I have no management of authority. If I disagree with something that the newsroom is doing on behalf of the listeners, then I can write a column. I have a weekly column that appears on NPR.org. Mostly we answer listener and reader emails. We get about 10,000 a year.
So 10,000?
10,000 a year. We try to answer, we don't answer them all, but we try to answer the vast majority of those emails personally.
Do you ever have an empty inbox? I just want to know.
No. And I apologize if you're one of the people who has written me, and we're a little behind at the moment. We have about 300 so that are still sort of backed up, but that's what I do.
Let's talk about the emails, the 10,000 emails. What does this look like? How do you do your job?
Right. So when the emails come in, we label them. So I have an assistant. Occasionally we have an intern who works with us as well. But all the emails that come in, we label them. We really wanted to understand what the ongoing concerns are. It's hard to keep track of that many emails that we get. So this is, you can see, the most popular email topics since the beginning of the year. So language is by far the biggest. I mean, if you were to add up left bias and right bias, bias would be the biggest concern.
But it's so interesting that you get concerns of left bias
and right
bias.
Yes.
What does that tell you?
You know, on the one hand, you could say, well, we get equal numbers of left and right, more or less, so that means NPR is doing something right. I don't always ascribe to that. I agree with that. You know, you can be wrong on both sides, right?
And yeah. I'd like to know, what elevates an email or a call that you get to the point of taking action or doing a little bit of digging?
We do a lot of digging on pretty much every email that comes in. So we get some ongoing concerns that if I've already written a column about it, we'll send them to that column. It's hard. We can't write about everything, so we do try to answer the emails. But if we get enough concerns or if it's really something that I agree with and think that there is a problem here in the newsroom, then I try to write a column about it.
How do you handle corrections? How do you just even address it and talk amongst yourselves with transparency? You know, hey, we could have done that better.
NPR is great about corrections. So where there's a corrections editor, there's a very easy link. One of the things that I wrote about a couple years ago was the corrections link, the link to submit a correction and the link to see the corrections that had already been made was not on the homepage. You had to go through a drop-down. You had to click through a few pages to get to the corrections. And so one of the things I said was, you know, you really have to have it much more front and center so that it's very clear that you do make corrections when things are wrong. I still have an issue with NPR. They very rarely do corrections on the air. They tend to do all the corrections on the website. Well, if you've heard it on air, as good transparency,
you should make it.
You should be correcting it on the air. I mean, their argument is, well, the same person won't be listening, or you know, you might listen at 5 o'clock one day and 6 o'clock the next day because of your schedule. You might have heard the misinformation, and you're not going to hear the correction. So, what's the point? As long as we're correcting it online, I disagree with them. So,
some people have a notion or an idea that it is possible for a journalist to be completely unbiased. Is this a realistic way to think about journalism?
I don't think so. Yeah, I think we all have opinions and points of view. I do know journalists, political journalists, who don't vote for that very reason, because they want to sort of clear their head. Other journalists vote, but I think the goal is to be fair. I was talking with someone earlier about that. You know, how you go about doing that is tricky. You know, you have to sort of, there's an expression, check your biases. So okay. You need to go back and say, okay, well, if this is my point of view, then what perspective am I missing that would counter that point of view? Just to really make sure that you're being fair and approaching things from multiple perspectives.
That was NPR's public editor Elizabeth Jensen speaking at a panel discussion on media bias in Boulder Saturday night. Tomorrow, we'll bring you another view of media bias from that event. Vanessa Otero was also part of our conversation. She's the creator of the Media Bias Chart. If you haven't seen it, you can do so at our website, kunc.org. And we also wanted to add a quick note about how we do corrections at Colorado Edition. We'll update listeners on the show as well as on the web. If you have any questions, let us know. Email coloradoedition@kunc.org.
Now, let's take a look at the headlines.
First, an update on something we talked about yesterday. A water auction in Loveland today set a new high price for a key northern Colorado water supply. The sale of land and water rights of the Sikich family's farm brought in close to $15 million, and about $10 million of that was spent on water rights. One unit of water from the Colorado Big Thompson project went for $60,000. That is a new record for the project. It was built in the 1930s to irrigate eastern Colorado farmland, but its water has increasingly been transferred to Front Range cities.
Steamboat Springs residents will see a citywide property tax question on the local ballot this November. The city council unanimously approved the measure at their meeting last night. The tax revenue would fund expansion of the city's fire and emergency medical services department. It would also be the first time the city has collected property taxes in 40 years.
A statewide map published this week shows temporary storage locations for firearms. The Colorado School of Public Health and other partners identified 15 law enforcement agencies and 47 gun shops around Colorado that offer out-of-home storage at varying costs. The map is intended to be a resource not only in times of crisis, but also for people looking to store their guns while traveling or hosting visitors.
And on the subject of guns, in some communities, gangs, drugs, and gun violence are all a part of a cycle of intergenerational trauma that is made worse by poor education.
And while mass shootings typically are what grab headlines, gun violence happens in communities all over the country. In 2018, according to the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, there were more than 6,000 violent crimes involving a gun.
Guns in America's Jonathan Levinson has the story of one man who decided the cycle ends with him. And a note for listeners, this story discusses gun violence and sex.
What's up, Queenie? What you doing, baby?
Lionel Irving's 16-year-old niece, Jalea, is just getting home from a summer program called Self-Enhancement, Inc.
I love you, Mama.
Love you, too.
Yes, man. She just came from a college tour.
I went to Tulane University.
Lionel sees education as the most important thing for helping young people.
I'm really big on education. Because that's the way to make it out.
That's how he made it out. Lionel's a big, soft-spoken guy. Growing up in Portland, Oregon, he was a charmer. He had good energy. But he never did very well in school, so he was always uncomfortable there. His mom, his uncles, people he looked up to, they were all involved with gangs and drug dealing. So in the sixth grade, he did what was comfortable. He joined a gang and started selling drugs.
Guns have impacted my life all the way back to before I was born, when the police killed my Uncle Ricky.
Ricky Johnson was killed by a Portland police officer in 1975. Older gang members recruited younger kids like Lionel to sell drugs and attack rivals. 12-year-olds are vulnerable. Maybe their dad is in jail. Or, like Lionel, maybe their mom was a drug addict. They're easy to manipulate, he says.
So he's searching for somebody to love him or to pay attention to him, whatever it is.
And when Lionel was older, when it was his turn to bring on younger kids, he did the same thing.
And so the cycle just continues.
It's a cycle that puts guns in the hands of kids.
The first time I saw somebody was in the sixth grade, and I was so scared. You know, I was terrified.
After that, he says it became easy. More importantly, people respected him. Suddenly, he had clout that he didn't have as an unsure kid in school.
I mean, I was high off of guns, and that, I was high off of that for a long time.
Lionel was close with his cousin Donald. When Donald was shot and killed in 1999, Lionel spent the next 2 years looking for revenge.
When I killed somebody in 2001.
And everything changed in an instant.
And then when it happened, it was such a terrible event. You could never unlive those moments. All the advice you heard leading up to that all makes sense now.
Lionel went to prison in 2004. He served 12 years for manslaughter. In prison, he enrolled in GED classes, but he had never learned how to read. And just like in middle school, he started acting out. So a teacher in prison tried something different. She put him in an English as a second language class, even though it was his only language. And he was skeptical. Teachers had been passing him off to other classes his whole life. Lionel says other prisoners cared about his education more than the prison did, but this worked.
It was amazing, man, because now I was smarter than these dudes, man.
He had confidence. His world opened up. He read his first book.
And it was like a book for a seven-year-old. You know what I mean? It just kicked the light on for me. Like, man, I was out another world.
Even before he got out, Lionel says he had become an activist. He wanted to help kids make better decisions before they wound up dead or in jail. He helped found a group called Men Building Men. Today, they're meeting in a Northeast Portland community center planning a back-to-school event.
How do we see the impact? You know,
the group brings together men from the community with elementary and middle schoolers to mentor them, to instill a culture of accountability. The goal is to break a cycle of violence that has played out over generations.
Yeah, the trauma is real, man. You know, and there's so many different levels of trauma, from hunger, you know, to just being ignored, to violence, to sexual. In the sixth grade, I was having sex with drug addicts. They were adults. I was only like 12 years old. That will warp a 12-year-old. These are grown-ups.
And guns.
I got like 30 tombstones, if not more, you know.
He lifts his shirt to show his tattoos.
Most of these are from gang violence. I didn't recognize it at first, that I suffered a lot of trauma from gun violence. Man, guns ain't never did nothing good for my family, you know.
That'll give the kids a lot of run-around time.
Halfway through the meeting, Lionel sees a truck drive by. It's a contractor who's working on his house. He says the guy stole money from him. Lionel learned early on to resolve conflict with violence. Situations like this, with the contractor, test a new set of skills. Skills that go back to that teacher in prison who, through education, gave him a chance to pick a different path.
I visualize how I'm going to talk to him, and I know he's going to make me mad. So how I'm going to end the conversation and get away where neither one of us have a problem.
He passed what he's learned on to his family.
No, we have no more criminals. No more inmates. We have no more gang members.
And now he wants to teach it to his community. For Guns in America, I'm Jonathan Levinson.
Guns in America is a public media reporting project on the role of guns in American life. You can find more at our website, KUNC.org.
You're listening to Colorado Edition from KUNC.
Pharmaceutical company AveXis has bought the former AstraZeneca plant in Longmont and plans to begin production of its flagship drug, the most expensive drug in the world, by the end of the year. But the company is currently in the midst of a federal investigation due to the approval process of that same drug. Dan Mica is a reporter for BizWest. He joins us now to tell us all about what's going on. Dan, welcome to Colorado Edition.
Thanks for having me, Henry.
Tell us about this drug that AveXis is producing.
The drug is called Zolgensma, and it's a gene therapy that is designed for children up to the age of 2 with spinal muscular atrophy. It's a condition where the children don't have the ability to stand up on their own or essentially move on their own because they don't have the motor neurons to kind of move around on their back. And most of them die around the age of 2 or 3 because their lungs just don't have the ability to keep oxygen flowing through their body. So it's a real death sentence for a lot of children, and there's about 400 kids every year are born with SMA in the United States. So Zolgensma is a gene therapy. You only take it once, and it should fix those problems. But it is the most expensive drug in the world right now at retail price. It goes for $2.1 million. The other SMA therapy on the market right now goes for about, I believe, $750,000 for the first one. And then every year with the additional coverage and the additional therapies will cost about $350,000 or so. So we're talking just extremely expensive drugs here, but they are life-saving.
And now, as we mentioned, the company AveXis currently tied up in a federal investigation. What's going on with that?
So AveXis, for a little bit of background, they're based out of Chicago, and they didn't have any real connection to the area until they bought the plant in Longmont to produce about 40% of their total of Zolgensma output. So March 14th, a scientist at AveXis flagged a discrepancy in the data of a clinical trial having to do only with mice, testing the drug out on animals. And the FDA was not made aware of this until after it had approved the drug on May 24th. And about a month later, in May 15th, Novartis, which is AveXis's parent company, started the investigation. So while the FDA says that the drug is still considered safe and effective, and AveXis is sticking by the drug. The real concern from the FDA is that AveXis knew that it had some kind of falsified data on its hands and didn't bother to tell the FDA. AveXis, for their part, fired the Caspar brothers, Brian and Alan Caspar. They were two of the top researchers at AveXis. And it should be noted that Brian Caspar, through an attorney, sent out a statement to a lot of the pharmaceutical industry newsletters saying that he categorically denies doing any wrongdoing.
We know from the company that they're planning on starting production by the end of the year. Do we know when the investigation will finish? Is that going to be over by the time production starts?
The FDA did say that they are looking at either civil or criminal penalties, but we haven't heard much from them since the original statement earlier this month. But we do know that Chuck Grassley, the Republican senator and the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, asked Novartis last week to provide any information it had regarding AveXis's data manipulation, so there may be a Senate investigation coming. I really would not be surprised if this particular incident becomes a story that we hear on the campaign trails, especially on the Democratic side. A group of five senators, including Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, signed a letter to the FDA essentially asking them to throw the book at AveXis for doing any kind of drug data manipulation. They want to really make this kind of like the poster boy for what happens if you try to mess with drugs. And it really does make for a good campaign stump speech, because it's a drug that is the most expensive in the world, and it is primarily for use in children that have a debilitating disease and are, you know, barely able to function without it. So this is going to continue, and I don't think it'll have any ramifications on the production itself in Longmont, but it is something to keep an eye on.
Dan Mica is a reporter for BizWest. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Colorado State University's fall semester began this week, and this year, the campus will see a new initiative thanks to Ryan Lanham. Lanham was wounded when he returned from the war in Afghanistan. His wounds weren't to his arms or legs, they were to his soul. Writing about it, he says, is helping him heal. And he wants other veterans to try it too. KUNC's Michael DeJuana has more. And a note, this story contains descriptions of war, substance abuse, and suicide.
A small crowd is gathered under a red and white striped tent on a recent evening near downtown Denver.
How are you guys feeling? Yeah? Like, I need like one more like big like woo. I need it. Vibrant is. Thank you ever so much. Let's keep that same energy for our next reader.
This is Lit Fest at the Lighthouse Writers Workshop. And the next reader, Ryan Lanham, is making his way around the plastic chairs to the microphone.
He was an infantryman in the army and deployed to Afghanistan.
And he's writing a memoir that deals with
the consequences of using combat as escape from a threadbare life of drugs and debauchery. The story is told as a series of vignettes.
Snapshots of existence, the MC goes on to say, that form a gestalt mosaic of a life upended, a turning away from the light, his dark night of the soul.
Without further ado, welcome. Give it up for Ryan Lanham.
Lanham begins reading from a piece called Clearing Instructions for the M4 Series Weapon. He says there's 9 steps.
Due to time constraints, I'll probably only make it through 6 of the steps, so if you come across an M4 after this, you're going to Google the last 3. Safe.
First, you place the weapon's selector lever on safe.
When I'm shaving in the side view mirror of my truck, dipping the razor into a cup of cold water, when mortars begin to fall out of the clear blue sky exploding all around us, I won't know which direction is safe.
Word by word, the piece gets more intense, culminating with the MC encouraging everyone to take a deep breath. The author of those words lives in Fort Collins on a street lined with big trees.
Hello.
Hey, Ryan.
Yeah, welcome. Hey. Come on in.
It's safe, far removed from the dangers he survived.
How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. How you doing?
Good.
Ryan Lanham has a kind smile, a shaven head, and a goatee. He's pursuing a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Nonfiction at Colorado State University. Born and raised in Fort Worth, Texas.
I was kind of a shy kid, a wallflower, so yeah. I stood back a little bit. My dad was a preacher on Sunday mornings to kind of a small congregation, living room preacher kind of guy, so conservative background.
But by the time he was in high school, he was doing drugs and drinking. It was a way to numb the emotional pain of a failed relationship.
And I had whatever that X factor is that was immediately an addict or an alcoholic. Blackout drinker from the first day, problematic for the next 15 years of my life.
In his mid-20s, he got a wake-up call. Friends had died because of their lifestyle choice. But some of his other friends had matured. They had careers in the military and were encouraging him to join.
So I thought about it for a while and realized, okay, I need a huge change. My life is flatlining here. I need to do something different. And I had been homeless. I was living on a couch for 3 years at this point.
By the time he met an Army recruiter in 2007, Lanham had a long list of substance abuse offenses to overcome. But he got in. So at 27 years old, he was an infantryman stationed at Fort Drum in New York.
The infantry route seemed like a way of having some crazy life-changing experience.
And that experience was in Afghanistan, at a forward operating base in the dangerous Logar province. He's written about it in horrific detail. I ask him to read from one of his vignettes. It's called Almost.
It's kind of this idea of almost something happening. A month ago, the first IED exploded under my truck. I was seated below the gunner near the rear. The blast was deafening. Time grew still. I watched as the innards of our metal beast lurched skyward. The black bands we used to strap down equipment inside the truck stretched with the force of the explosion. If one snapped, whatever it held down would become a projectile, ammo cans, MREs, radios.
After returning from overseas in 2009, he had run-ins with the law and wound up in the Army's substance abuse program. That helped him stay clean until after he was discharged. But back in Texas, he discovered a newer problem: psychological trauma from the emotional impacts of war. He started drinking again.
And somehow that was still a better option than whatever my regular state of mind was. And sure enough, within a year, I had spiraled down as low as you could get. Wrecked the car, spent all the money, lost my job, got kicked out of school, was losing the apartment.
It was a vicious circle. Only now, he was 31 years old.
So, with all the drinking, and I was doing drugs, and all the residual stuff from war, you know, the scenes from there, I just thought, nope, gonna end it.
He failed in his attempts. And then he found help and treatment on the Western Slope at the Colorado Addiction and Rehab Treatment Center. There, he latched on to a simple suggestion to stay sober.
One of their big focuses is how to have fun. So when you show up there, part of the cost gets you a ski pass, and you do mountain bike trips in Moab, and you get a gym membership and yoga.
All of that was more than 7 years ago. Sobriety followed, and a degree in history from the University of Colorado. Finally, at CSU, one of his mentors asked if he wanted to write about his war experiences. Before then, it hadn't occurred to him. And now, he's adding those experiences to everything else.
Yes, I'm working on my project. It's going to have, you know, its place in the public. But what about all the people who are silenced?
Those people are veterans, he says, and writing has been proven to help them. Researchers with the Department of Veterans Affairs have found that creative writing reduces post-traumatic stress symptoms. That's in a study of 1,300 Iraq and Afghanistan vets. They also had lower levels of anger, distress, even fewer physical complaints, while reporting higher levels of social support. And here's where CSU fits in.
For the next 2 years, the school has created an internship position where I will be in charge of turning this into like a really well-oiled machine that hopefully exists in perpetuity after me.
In his way, Ryan Lanham is helping to bridge what experts describe as the military-civil divide. It says the general public knows too little about the sacrifices of troops and their families, especially those involved in war. And the project isn't just about students at CSU. It's about creating more dialogue for veterans' issues across northern Colorado.
All the people who don't speak about this stuff or who think, well, I'm not a writer, those are the people we want. We just want your voice out there for the therapeutic value of writing it, and then for the public to read it and understand people's experience that they may not understand.
The vision is to publish stories annually from student veterans, veterans in the community, and others like family members who may find that putting a story to paper has a healing power. Michael DeJoanna, KUNC.
That's our show for today. Tomorrow in Colorado Edition, we explore average teacher salaries across the state and what school districts are doing to address the issue.
I'm Erin O'Toole.
I'm Henry Zimmerman. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer.
This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. Thanks for listening.